Gaudas is one of the world's leading experts on Paleolithic nutrition and author of the international best-selling book Primal Body, Primal Mind, Beyond the Paleo Diet for Total Health and a Longer Life. She is board certified in holistic nutrition through the National Association of Nutritional Professionals and is a certified nutritional therapist. Nora served as a trainer for the State of Washington Institute of Mental Health, illuminating nutrition's impact on mental health for state health care workers at all levels. She maintains a private practice in Portland, Oregon, as both a certified nutritional therapist and a board-certified clinical neurofeedback specialist. In August 2011, Nora was featured presenter at the Ancestral Health Symposium at UCLA, billed as the Woodstock of evolutionary medicine. Today we're going to discuss the pre-agriculture diet and lifestyle. Also, we cover the negative impacts of agriculture upon our environment and the ill effects of grain in our bodies. Nora provides specific information on why the paleo diet is the best for the human body. Stay with us for much more on this. Welcome to Red Ice Radio, Nora. It's good to have you with us here today. Thank you for taking the time talking with us. How are you today?
I'm wonderful, Henrik, and thank you so much for having me. This is a real honor and privilege for me to be here.
Thank you very much. We heard about your work a while back. We've been interested in the health issues, if I can kind of frame it like that. This is a broad subject, of course. A lot of things goes into it, but we've been interested in that for a long time. And a while back, we talked about the dangers of wheat, and this is going to kind of serve as a follow-up, if you will, to that, and expanding a little bit more on that and talk more widely about it. Why don't we talk about some of the basics first, Nora, and basically let us know what the paleo diet is for people who might never even have heard about this before.
Well, my book uses the paleo diet as sort of a starting place, but I sort of step beyond it a little bit. But for those who are not real clear about what the actual paleo diet per se is, that's gaining in popularity now in a lot of circles, and actually it's different things to different people. But we're basically talking about the stretch of human history from about 2.5, actually more like 3.5 now it turns out, a million years ago, to about 10,000 years ago or so at the advent of the introduction of agriculture, and what kinds of foods we were eating through most of our history, basing the diet on basically what kinds of selective pressures shaped our physiological makeup and our nutritional requirements through the vast majority of our evolutionary history. And so it's basically a pre-agricultural diet, and in effect a hunter-gatherer diet.
Now, this is something that has been of interest to me. We've talked about the origins of farming many times in the program before, because it seems like a sidestep almost in a way. This is what of course explains civilization. It explains in some cases, even if it's true or not, how mankind has been able to pull these things off that we call cities and civilization, I guess. But
right.
Why is it so have you come any closer to what the reasons were why mankind moved away from this? Is it because of so-called civilization, cities, and settling in one area? Or what's the explanation?
Well, I think agriculture gave rise to that settling in one area. And why we adopted agriculture is a question. Some people believe it's because at the end of the last ice age, there was a great die-off of the megafauna that we relied on for sort of the mainstay in our diet through a very great portion of our history. And some of that may have been due to overhunting, or at least that some there are some people that believe that it was our overhunting of these animals that in part led to their demise and forced us to turn to something else. But I also think and this is more recently I've come to think more in terms of the fact that we discovered a food source in grains. And it's basically, it was an inferior food source, but it's one that we decided that we liked. And in fact, there are exorphins, there are morphine-like compounds in grains that I think we just sort of became addicted to, honestly.
Hmm.
I mean, why we would have gone from a nomadic lifestyle that was comparatively much easier in some ways, to, you know, spending hours and hours of backbreaking labor in the fields to produce a food source that was tremendously inferior in so many respects, and why we would have built our entire culture around that type of food source, you know, becomes, well, obviously, as soon as you're dependent on agriculture, you've got to stay put. You're sort of ball and chain to wherever you are.
Yeah.
And so that certainly opened the door to what we call so-called civilization. But it also opened the door to rapidly mounting human populations. The human populations around the world just sort of exploded as soon as this sort of cheap, readily available food source became cultivated and widely used.
Have you heard anything about the level of health that was previous to mankind settling down in the beginning
well,
of farming?
Yeah. Yeah. If you're a paleontologist, you can look at a set of human remains and be able to tell whether they were pre-agricultural or post-agricultural. You can see by virtue of, pre-agriculturally, we had much greater bone density, we had greater stature, we had fewer birth defects, fewer if any. We did not suffer the degenerative diseases anywhere near to the degree that we did post-agriculturally. And we didn't have the deficiencies that could show up, in bone, and we didn't have the dental problems that we had. So it's very clear that once we adopted agriculture, we became tremendously compromised in a whole variety of ways.
That's very interesting. We have so many health issues we're struggling with today, cancer, diabetes, I mean, you name it, it's off the charts, basically. How much of this do you think we have to attribute to the food we eat, nutrition, etc.?
Well, pretty much all of it. Well, nutrition and also, obviously, the environment we've created for ourselves. But our nutritional status helps to shore up our resistance to environmental contaminants and other things. And unfortunately, we're so many generations now influenced by, because each subsequent generation becomes increasingly vulnerable with an inferior diet. I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Dr. Francis Pottinger. He wrote a book back in the 1930s called Pottinger's Cats,
mm-hmm.
where he was an MD that studied that had three groups of cats, and he was doing this sort of research where he took one group of cats and fed them what would be a natural diet for them, which was basically sort of a raw meat and raw meat diet. And he took the next group of cats and he fed them nothing but cooked food, and then the third group of cats he fed them nothing but processed foods. And he saw some impact on the health of that first generation, but it was relatively small. But with each subsequent generation, what became alarming was the rapid deterioration of the progeny of each subsequent generation. And by the 10th generation of these cats, they were not even able to reproduce at all. There were severe issues with the mental health of these cats, as well as the physical health of these cats, and birth defects and all sorts of challenges to their health. And obviously it's a clear reflection of what we see in our own, human populations today.
Wow, that's just amazing. By the 10th generation, and I want to get into this idea also of how this affects our mentally. Your book title is Primal Body and Primal mind. And, right. and I want to get into the mind aspect to this as well. Very, very interesting. But, okay, for those people then who would argue, well, you know, we are very different than the makeup of cats. We, you know, have different, you know, sort of, you know, genes. We can, you know, deal with different foods in a different way. What would you say about that?
Well, the idea isn't that we are identical to cats, although we share, you know, we're closer to being carnivores than we are herbivores. Physiologically. But the idea is to eat the foods, by eating the foods that are natural for us to eat, but that our physiological makeup is designed, to process and make use of, we're maximizing the potential for health. As soon as we start doing things that are unnatural, that are foreign to our physiological makeup, we start developing problems. And this ends up, you know, it's not just that we pay the price, but our future generations pay the price.
Absolutely.
And that's, you know, it just stands to reason. That, you know, my book is basically predicated on the idea that our ancestors gave us clues about how we should be eating based on our physiology and also based on the selective pressures that they were faced with over 3.5 million years or so of our evolutionary history. And it's also predicated on the fact that modern science, and specifically modern longevity science, also gives us clues about how we can adapt these principles to shape our health and our longevity in more specific ways. And that's something I talk about later in my book as well. But, you know, there's a tremendous amount of logic that comes to bear in this.
I agree. I think we have to look at what has been natural in mankind's past first to be able to determine how we're going to carry on in the future. We can't just change our behavior overnight, basically, which is what happened in the perspective of you know, the long term when mankind shifted over to farming and such like that. But let's talk a little bit about the specifics of what some of the problems are of grains, gluten, soy, dairy and starchy vegetables, and maybe begin to make a little distinction of what you consider to be good things and bad things, perhaps.
Well, I don't actually find much of anything that's particularly health promoting with respect to grains at all. We've been consuming grains as a species now. Now, a lot of people think 10,000 years is a long time in the span of human history. It's a heartbeat. And we've been consuming grains less than 0.4% of our entire genetic history, and yet we've changed genetically. We've adapted genetically over the last 10,000 years, maybe 0.005%. So we're not designed for this as a primary foodstuff. And yet, if you look at the U.S. Department of Agriculture's pyramid, mm-hmm. food pyramid, mm-hmm. you know, according to them, that's supposed to be the foundation and the basis of the human diet. And I can tell
right.
you that no human people group in the history of the human species has ever eaten a diet that remotely resembles what the USDA food pyramid suggests is optimal. that this is something that is based on politics and economics and not on science, and certainly not with respect to human health at all. And whatever the small modifications are that they've made to it have been minor. Now they've turned it into a plate instead of a pyramid, which I think of as a frisbee. But, you know, our ancestors didn't use plates. they just simply ate what was natural for them to eat. And if you've ever spent time out in the wilderness, if you find yourself cold and in a remote place and you've forgotten to pack, you know, food and now you're kind of sitting out there trying to figure out what to do, I promise you that you're not dreaming of a salad and you know, grains are not something that would be readily available to you there. That the more nutrient dense that foods were, the more important they were to us always throughout history.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've heard of the work also of Weston Price. I'm sure you've come across that.
This is the guy who looked at the teeth, right? Of Nate.
Yes. He was the president of what was called the National Dental Association way back when, and in the 20s and 1930s, he noticed that the teeth of the children of his patients were, substantially worse. They were having many more problems and many more health problems than the parents were, and he saw that this broad sort of deterioration of health occurring in society, and he wondered, because he was a bit of an anthropologist and had a tremendous interest in primitive cultures and knew of their reputation for having superb teeth and mental and physical health, that he thought maybe there was something related to diet that had something to do with this. So he set out across the world and spent 10 years, traveled over 100,000 miles, studying cultures that were both primitive cultures and also traditional cultures throughout the world that had been, that were eating a diet that their ancestors had eaten for many thousands of years. And he went to, he was among the Aborigine in Australia and native people in northern Alaska and the Inuit, and he went to the Outer Hebrides Islands and ancient Celtic Isles and studied cultures there. He was in the Lochental Valley in Switzerland and all over Africa. And what he found consistently throughout the world in the cultures where people were maintaining their traditional diets was a distinct lack of the degenerative diseases that were characterizing modern times. And he, of course, exhaustively photographed all of the people in these cultures, and he studied their health, examined the state of their health and their dental health. He also took samples of all their foods and analyzed them to the extent that was possible in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that he found consistently was that all of these cultures consumed as many animal source foods as were available to them. And the foods that were actually the most sacred and important to them were the most fat-rich foods, the most nutrient-dense. He never found a vegan culture, as hard as he tried to seek one out. He really was intent on trying to find one. He was never able to find one.
Mm-hmm.
But wherever he found that these people were starting to move into cities and adapt more of the Western dietary approaches of the time, what he called consuming the moods of the foods of modern commerce, more processed foods and things like that, he saw rapid deterioration in health, many more birth defects, many more dental defects and problems, malocclusion and all these kinds of things, as well as mental illness and the things that characterize our modern-day life. And so he ended up chronicling all of this in a classic book now referred to as Nutrition and Physical Degeneration, which, by the way, was required reading in Harvard anthropology classes for many years following its publication.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still, I think, one of the most important books ever published on diet and health, not next to mine, of course, but but really remarkable piece of work.
There's been a debate for a long time about fat, different kinds of fat, what is good, what we should try to avoid. It's hardly a discussion one can have without looking at the industry behind it of margarine and all these other, really, really bad things for you. But what can you say about, natural fats that promote health versus other types of fats that actually is harmful?
Well, that's the key, is the term natural fats that are naturally occurring in the foods that we eat that were raised or grown naturally. In other words, animals that were raised, the fat from meat of animals that were raised out in fresh air and sunshine, allowed to eat what was natural to them, which is fresh green grass, versus grains and corn and soybeans and all of the rest, which aren't natural, any more natural for cows than they are for us. People have a tendency to generalize when they talk about fat. Fats are actually an extremely diverse family of compounds, and even saturated fat comes in different forms that are utilized very differently by the body. Now, there are short-chain saturated fats, short- and medium-chain saturated fats that have some important antimicrobial properties that actually tend to bypass the gallbladder and are used more preferentially for energy by us and also by the cells of our large intestine. Butyric acid, for instance, which is found in significant quantities in butter, which is what butter is named for, is the primary source of nutrition for the large for the cells of the large intestine of the colon. The medium chain fats, which are also saturated, are found in things like coconut oil and palm oils and things like that. And they actually have some rather profound antimicrobial properties. In fact, coconut oil is about 50% of coconut oil is made up of something called lauric acid, which converts to monolaurin in the body. Monolaurin may be the single most potent natural antiviral agent known.
Yeah, coconut is just an amazing nut.
It is an amazing thing. I mean, it's a marvelous food in many respects, but the fat itself, it's the most saturated fat that there is just about, and it's probably the safest thing we can cook with. And in addition to that, it has many, many other beneficial properties. But it also, it bypasses biliary digestion, gets absorbed directly into portal blood, converts very readily to ketones, which are then very usable by every organ in our body, including our brains. So it, and all fats can potentially become ketones, but coconut fat does this faster than any other form of fat. And then there are the long chain fats, and then, long chain saturated fats. And for instance, 18 carbon, stearic acid, and I think it's 16 carbon palmitic acid are the preferred fuel, by the way, for the human heart.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the human heart uses preferentially to anything else to fuel itself. And so we're more likely to store those longer chain fats. But everything, the idea is to get fat from a variety of natural sources. Now, if all we're doing is getting our fat from the carbohydrates that we eat, which we then readily convert to a certain form of palmitic acid, what we're doing is we're for starters packing on the kind of fat that nobody wants to have, but we're also eliminating the diversity that have a tremendous variety of roles to play. Roughly half the fat in the human brain is saturated. And in fact, most of the cholesterol, the largest repository of cholesterol in the human body is actually in the human brain. And then about 11% of the fatty acids in the brain are made up of arachidonic acid, which is an omega-6. Sometimes omega-6 fats get a bad rap because they tend toward being pro-inflammatory. Well, again, all natural fats have a role to play in our health. And if the idea isn't that we should get all of this and none of that, the idea is to get a balance.
That's,
and, of course, the omega-3s, which are so popular, you know, they have a role to play also. But they need to be in a relative balance with omega-6s. Unfortunately, omega-3s have been largely stripped from the food supply. And if you're eating the meat of a grain-fed animal or you're eating a farm-raised fish, you're not likely to be getting any omega-3s at all. So the idea is to stick with meat of animals. I mean, the meat of a cow that has been exclusively pasture-fed, never spent any time in a feedlot, may have more omega-3s per gram than wild-caught salmon. It's a very rich source. And that's where our ancestors got these things, from wild game, you know, as well as wild-caught fish. So, and the plant sources of omega-3s are actually not very well usable by us at all. We don't convert them very readily, and many of us don't convert them at all. I dare say you guys up there in Sweden may not make those conversions at all, because there's people of Celtic descent and Northern European descent and native descent lack an enzyme that allows for the conversion of plant source omega-3s into that elongated EPA and DHA that we need so much of.
So that's bad news for vegetarians and vegans then, right?
It is very bad news. And you know, in my work here in Portland, I work with the brain. I do brain training a lot with people, something called neurofeedback. And I deal with, you know, people who are coming in with all manner of mental and emotional complaints and issues, as well as certain physical issues. And you know, any time you're training the brain to function better, it can help a lot with a lot of these things. And it's mainly a way for the to raise the bar of stress. You know, this is really profound stress management. The brain is learning how to manage its own states by raising the stress threshold. But I will say the most damaged and most intractably damaged brains and nervous systems I have ever worked with have been vegetarians and vegans by far. And we can be doing the best quality intervention in the world. I can be doing the best brain training protocol for that person in the world, and yet it's not going to put a nutrient there that's not there, and it's not going to take away some offending substance or antigen that doesn't belong. The brain and the body need certain raw materials in order to function, and there are a number of things that we require, that we have to have, that truly only come, in fact, from animal sources. And that's just reality. And I'm very sympathetic to the sort of, to the concern for the welfare of animals and of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of what vegetarians and vegans have been led to believe lead to greater welfare of the planet with their dietary choices are doing the opposite to the planet. Nothing has been more devastating to the welfare of this planet than the inception of agriculture. Nothing has done more damage worldwide. Monoculture agriculture in particular has just absolutely decimated topsoils, and we're now riddled with pesticides and all manner of chemicals, and of course genetic modifications and all kinds of things now that are influencing health on a mass scale in unprecedented ways in all of our history. And most of the planet is not agriculturally utilizable. Most of the planet is, there are grasslands and many places in the world where grazing animals can thrive, where it's not possible, to grow food. And, grazing animals have existed en masse for all of the, for a good chunk of this planetary history. And, the planet did just fine with masses of grazing animals before we came along and started manipulating things. And that's the real problem.
Very interesting. It's that idea obviously is counterintuitive of what we're getting now to a certain extent in a way from the official sources. They say that it's bad for the environment to be a carnivore. And some people even argue that, we're too many people on the planet, and hence if everybody, had a meat diet or maybe even the kind of diet that you're talking about now, it wouldn't work. Have you looked at anything in terms of the numbers on that, and if that's true or not?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be true. And if we're talking about eating the meat of feedlot animals, then I don't have an argument with that. That is not sustainable. And again, that's grains and corn and soybeans are not natural foods for cows either. There is a man by the name of Alan Savory, and he's doing his work in Zimbabwe in Africa. And I urge your listeners to go to his website. I believe it's the savoryinstitute.com. And the work that he's doing there is basically restoring healthy watersheds, restoring the environment, and reversing desertification with the use of grazing animals. His work has garnered the interest of many world leaders, many environmentally concerned leaders have gone and seen what he's doing there, and it's quite remarkable. And he has people that he's trained all over the world. In fact, when I did a tour through Australia last November and spoke at the several universities there, and And the group that sponsored me had Savory Institute representatives at each of my talks. Each of them, you know, got about an hour or so to talk, an hour or two to talk. I talked all day at these universities, and
mm-hmm.
There were Savory Institute representatives there showing the work that they were doing, and it's absolutely remarkable. This is something that can literally reverse the problems that we have on the planet. Many of these environmental issues that people have concerns with. And yes, I think if we approach the issue with thoughtfulness and very consciously, and we go about systematically restoring the health of grassland, and we raise the animals that we raise for food in a manner that is more natural to them, it is a potentially doable thing. One of the things that I talk about in my book is the fact that, you know, that eating this sort of primal approach doesn't mean that you're eating slabs and slabs and slabs of meat every day.
Right. Yeah.
I personally don't eat more than maybe 2 or 3 ounces of complete protein in a meal, you know, of animal source protein in a meal. The idea is to meet your protein requirement, but there's no benefit really to exceeding that protein requirement. Now, unless you're a growing child or you're pregnant or something like that, I don't want to say that this is that restricting protein is something that is necessarily optimal for them. I think children and pregnant women should eat as much as they need to
mm-hmm.
of these foods, but and can eat a little more. But for those of us that are adults and are not pregnant, that there's no benefit to exceeding our daily protein requirement. We need a certain amount of complete protein. In other words, having all the essential amino acids present every day in order for proper protein synthesis in our body to occur. We've got protein doing about 55,000 different things. So we need to meet those basic requirements, but when we exceed them, there are some potentially detrimental aspects to that, and there aren't additional benefits. For starters, when we exceed our protein requirements, our body will tend to convert the excess to sugar and use it the same way.
Mm-hmm.
But also we're activating certain metabolic pathways, and some of this is very new in the research. There is a metabolic pathway that senses protein and then activates cellular proliferation, which if we're growing, that's a potentially good thing. Or if we're reproducing, that's potentially a good thing. But if we're of kind of a post-reproductive age, and now we start activating, once our DNA starts to get damaged and whatever else, things that stimulate cellular proliferation, it is a potential setup for cancers and other degenerative processes.
Hmm,
so,
Nora, what would that mean for, well, someone who's let's say lifting weights and doing a good version, or there are good sources of whey protein out there, for instance? Is that a still?
Well, right. And when you're talking about elite athletes or people doing things that you know, I don't necessarily consider bodybuilding to be the most natural activity. I'm not
right,
saying people
yeah.
shouldn't do it. But when we're doing things that are things that probably our ancestors would have scratched their heads over, you know, the way that certain athletes will attempt to, elite athletes will prepare for, say, Olympic events and things like that, the kind of regimen that they're on is something that wouldn't have made any sense at all to a primitive ancestor. They would have thought, my God, what an incredible waste of energy. And because we require that... The sugar for us, that carbohydrates are basically our version of rocket fuel. And when we're trying to exert ourselves or exceed our current capacity in some way, we tend to default back onto a dependence on those things to fuel those efforts. Most of the time, we don't have that much of a need for rocket fuel in our day-to-day lives,
mm-hmm.
which is another very important part of what I talk about in my book, is, you know, I make the case for largely eliminating sugar and starch from your diet. But in an elite athlete or in a bodybuilder, there may be an increased requirement for those kinds of things because of what you're asking your body to do on a day-to-day basis. You're basically pushing yourself beyond your limits on a day-to-day basis in order to try to, you know, prepare for whatever these events are. And you may, unnatural goals may require unnatural means to achieve those goals.
Well, exactly. They do drugs and all kinds of stuff, you know, to try to push, you know, all the time the boundary of what they can do, you know, with the body.
Right.
So, yeah,
of course. There aren't too many healthy bodybuilders, and I know that there are exceptions to that. And I actually know that there are triathletes and people who have figured out how to live a very low-carbohydrate lifestyle, and what they do is they just sort of cycle in things like sweet potatoes and whatever one day a week in order to replenish their glycogen store so that they can, you know, continue training in the manner that they're needing to train. So there are ways of getting around this, but by and large, elite athletes are going to require something slightly different than most of us will.
That's right. Let's talk a little bit more about sugar and also what happens in the body when, well, we could talk about what happens when we eat refined sugar, but also then wheat and things like that, and how this converts in the body to sugar, basically.
Well, wheat does a whole lot of things. You know, really only in modern times have we ever, as human beings, created this emergency physiological need to lower blood sugar, okay? And we're extremely poorly adapted to this modern need. You know, we think of insulin, for instance, as a blood sugar hormone, but that's not really what it is. It will lower blood sugar by default, but we actually have several blood sugar hormones, and they're all designed to kind of increase blood sugar in emergency-type situations. And we have our adrenal hormones, adrenaline and cortisol, epinephrine, norepinephrine. We have, you know, growth hormone. We have glucagon. These things will stimulate blood sugar. But we only have one hormone that is actually able to do anything to lower blood sugar. And insulin's primary role really isn't as a blood sugar hormone. It's mostly designed to take excess nutrients from the diet and put them into storage in case of a famine. And its actual role physiologically, it turns out, and biologically, because in insulin's role across all species from yeast to primates, and it's the exact same molecule in all of these organisms. And you don't really think of yeast as having blood sugar. But insulin's role is the coordination of our energy stores with reproduction and lifespan. But it will take excess nutrients, and virtually every molecule of carbohydrate that we consume that we don't need to outrun a charging rhino right now can be considered excess. So when we consume sugar in any form, and by the way, all carbohydrates other than fiber, but all sugar and starch are converted, they're sugar once they hit the bloodstream. And that includes these so-called complex carbohydrates like grains, whole grains, and brown rice, and all of these things, you know, potatoes, whatever. It's all sugar once it hits your bloodstream.
Wow.
And once they hit our bloodstream, again, whatever we don't need for rocket fuel right now your body attempts to store it in your liver and your muscles as glycogen for later. But we can only do that in a really limited way. We can't store more than a couple thousand calories in general for that. So the rest of it ends up getting sent to your liver to get converted to triglycerides and then stored as body fat, the kind that we would prefer not to have, most of us. But blood sugar also, any amount of blood sugar, but particularly when it elevates after a sugar starch-rich meal, it generates very damaging free radical activity and something called glycation. And glycation is this process by which the sugar in your bloodstream will combine with proteins and fats in your tissues and cause them to become sticky and misshapen over time and start to malfunction. This is how we age.
Mm.
And in fact, the substances that form are called advanced glycosylation end products, or AGEs, appropriately. And they also trigger a tremendous amount of inflammation in the body. And so, so the degree to which we're consuming foods that generate that process is the degree to which we are more rapidly aging ourselves. And in fact, it turns out that the less sugar we consume and also the less insulin we produce, because insulin is also a key player in aging, the less we require and the less we consume of things that stimulate insulin, the healthier we are and the longer we live and the more gracefully we age by far.
Interesting.
But of all of the major macronutrients, proteins, fats, and carbohydrates, and water, I guess, the only one for which there is literally no actual human dietary requirement is carbohydrate. We don't have to have any. And we're able to produce virtually all the needed glucose in our bodies from a combination of protein and fat in the diet through a process called gluconeogenesis. We're able to make our own.
Interesting. Again, the full title is Primal Body, Primal Mind, and Beyond the Paleo Diet for Total Health and a Longer Life. So this is obviously a theme in your book, as you mentioned as well, the term of how to, the problem, I guess, of how to age well, of course, without getting sick and all the rest of it. But how is it with vegetables, then, if we talk a little bit about that? Are all vegetables good? Are there better or worse vegetables?
Well, we don't have an actual human physiological requirement for them, which I know might be a bit of a shock. But there's certainly ample evidence that we spent stretches of our evolutionary history without access to those things. During ice ages where we were in more northern climates and things like that, places in the world where there was permafrost, you know, we just didn't have salads. All that said, though, I personally believe that fibrous vegetables and greens are probably more important to us today than they ever used to be, simply by virtue of some of the beneficial phytonutrients they contain, as well as many of the antioxidants that they contain. And we're up against things in our environment that our ancestors could not have even have begun to imagine. We're being exposed to pesticides and pollutants in our air and water and all kinds of artificial additives in our food supply, whether we're aware of them, of being there or not. We're dealing with levels of stress that are extremely unnatural. And now, of course, you know, we have EMF pollution. So much of what is impacting us are things that are invisible.
Yeah.
To us. There's, of course, radiation now is a real concern all over the northern hemisphere and apparently increasingly into the southern hemisphere as well,
mm-hmm.
which is not good news.
No.
We have a lot of things lacking in our food supply and a lot of, we have GMOs and we have heavy metal toxicities and there are just so many things impacting us. We're literally in a place in our evolutionary history now where we have no room for error with what we need to do in order to remain reasonably healthy. And I'm not even talking optimally healthy. Everything in my book is geared toward optimization of health. These are the things, if you want to best optimize your health, that you need to do. But I'm here to tell you, we're fighting against a whitewater current.
Hmm.
And I think, you know, I wrote a blog post about this around the first of the year. You know, there's this whole Occupy movement happening globally now. And, it's very well-meaning, and it's heartening to see people recognizing that, hey, wait a second, we're the 99% here. Part of what's unfortunate about that, though, is that you go to any one of these marches and you see 1,000 different people marching with signs that each have a different slogan, that there's
mm-hmm.
not really a consolidation and a focus on on an actionable objective. But I think what we, the thing I want to make a case for is the idea that people just, first and foremost, recognize the importance of occupying your own body and mind, or occupying your own health and your own food supply.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because there's absolutely nothing more foundational and to our health and well-being than that, or nothing more foundational to our survival. And if you get, I mean, the number one cause actually in the United States now of bankruptcy, for instance, is a bad diagnosis. I mean, if you've been diagnosed with cancer or heart disease, or, you know, you've had a stroke or who knows what, or you get diabetes or whatever, do you really give a rat's behind what the banksters are up to?
Right, yeah.
that there's nothing more important than, I think, a focus first and foremost on health. And I think that what this means is a real commitment to fully conscious eating and making a point of becoming really aware of where your food actually comes from. As much as possible, getting your food only from places where you know exactly where it came from. In other words, establishing, going to local farmers markets and establishing relationships with people producing food in your local area as much as possible. And understanding how that food is being raised. And obviously, you know, promoting and supporting those farmers that are working very, very hard to do the right thing. Raise their animals in humane ways and in very natural ways out in fresh air and sunshine. This obviously calls to a new level of personal responsibility. It also means that we're not just blindly accepting what we're told by mainstream sources that I think are much more interested in profit than our well-being, and you know, means saying no to laws that restrict our access to healthy and unadulterated food, saying no to GMOs, saying no to the efforts that are being put forth now across the globe. And I know this is happening where you are, Henrik. You know, we're really being limited in our access to quality nutritional supplements alternative care options, you know, of our choice. It's a very big deal. I think we need to say no to monoculture, agriculture and factory farming and all these inhumane commercial livestock practices and feedlot practices. And it also means speaking up in restaurants and going to your grocers and just saying, these are the foods I want, these are the foods I won't eat. And, you know, you can be nice about it, you don't have to be a curmudgeon. But making those that are attempting to profit from you aware of where you want to put your money.
Yeah, that's right. Communicate. It's not much more difficult than that, really. I mean, okay, people have to have a willingness to work with you on that, of course. But I think you're right. If people begin to, demand or suggest something, I think those who sell us the food and the service in the restaurants will listen, undoubtedly. I think so.
Yes. Yeah, those in grocers tend to listen. I think some of this, too, requires us to look in the mirror and become candid with ourselves about our own addictions and our own sort of weaknesses and vulnerabilities and the ways in which we avoid these issues because they're uncomfortable to think about. People today are using food, I think, too much as self-medication, as ways of just sort of numbing themselves oftentimes. There's been a real uptick in alcohol consumption. There's been a real uptick in so-called the consumption of various comfort foods and things like that at a time when really we need to be focused on the opposite. We really need our mental faculties to be at their best in challenging times. We need our physical health. I mean, if you cannot afford to get sick, and who can? And especially here in the States where nobody has health insurance anymore, you cannot afford to not eat optimally well and do everything possible to support your most natural and optimal health. And so I think that is the best type of Occupy movement that one can have.
Mm.
But it also means that there's not a leader in this, that we all take personal responsibility.
I think that's very good, Nora. I think that's an excellent point as well. And I do want to, well, here in our next segment, because we're coming a little bit here soon to the end of the first segment here, but I want to get into the primal mind, because there seems something is going on with mankind's brain functions, if you will, the capability of thinking rationally, and the fact,
oh boy,
if this is connected then to our food. I mean, that's immensely interesting, the opiates that you mentioned before, the fact that we might be looking at a situation where they now have practically taken over and we are run by them to a certain extent. But some people,
yeah,
just here before we run things off, though, some people might be scratching their heads now and thinking, well, you know, okay, you talked a bit about meat and stuff, and then you know, Nora didn't really get into, like, promoting the vegetables that much. What can we eat then? You know, there might be some people out there like, what are we talking about? Because we are disconnected from what and how our ancestors lived. So I also wanted to ask you, on top of that, if there are food sources, rather, that we have forgotten about, things that we might have been eating in the past, considering how homogenized everything has become now, and the choice is very limited. So what do we eat on the paleo diet?
Well, you know, typically what you would see on my plate would be some source of complete protein, whether it be from any kind of meat, poultry, fish, seafood of some kind, although I'm eating less of that nowadays for reasons we can talk about later.
Mm-hmm.
The oceans are becoming a big concern, the contamination of the oceans. But, I will have usually a significant, you might see a big pile of steamed vegetables. I eat some of my vegetables lightly cooked, some of them raw, fibrous vegetables and greens from, you know, just a variety of different, what we call kind of above ground fibrous plant foods, not the starchy roots and tubers so much, but the above ground kinds of things. And then, you know, salads and things like that, and then as much dietary fat as you need in order to satisfy your appetite, not being afraid of the fat that is present in meat. You can use extra olive oil, cook with coconut oil, cook your foods in tallows and organic and healthfully produced lards and things of that nature. It sounds like a limited way to eat, but I promise you that it's not. These things can be combined and put together in all kinds of innovative ways, and it's an extremely palatable diet, and one in which you need absolutely never be hungry. I don't know if there's...
Sorry, I just wanted to ask as well, is there something, sure, to this idea that when we also change our diet, we obviously change the way that we not only think about food but feel about food, meaning we might not have that same level of craving where we tend to,
yes,
eat as much as we did before, for example.
That is a very, very good point, because I used to eat a pretty high carbohydrate diet, and I used to crave that stuff. I used to eat a lot of grains, unfortunately. I can tell you that those kinds of foods just aren't even on my radar screen anymore. Not because I really shouldn't think about that. It's just I have no desire for those foods anymore. And really, the more sweet, for instance, that you eat, the more sweet things you will crave. Sugars will stimulate opiate receptors in the brain, in the nucleus accumbens of the brain, and cause you to crave those foods more. You're literally activating, these things are attaching to the same receptors morphine would in your brain, and causing, you know, stimulation of and release of dopamine, which is a very pleasurable chemical. And so one of the major reasons people have such a hard time stopping, in part, they become dependent on sugar as their primary source of fuel, which is not a natural state for us to be in. And in addition to that, there are exorphins, there's morphine-like compounds in grains and also in certain milk products that cause us to become addicted to these foods. And so, and you know, addiction definitely has a role to play in human behavior, and in the way we think about things, and it also the way our emotional states operate. And it's a wonderful thing to liberate yourself from that and see the world through a lens that's a little bit clearer. And that's certainly something that we can get into in the kind of the mental health part of this, because I literally have an all-day workshop that I teach on the subject of nutrition and mental health, and there's a tremendous amount that can be done to address this.
Very interesting. Very good, Nora. Let's talk a little bit about, I mean, your book has so many great chapters in it and so many, you know, different sections here that we can talk about and that we should talk about as well here in the second. I definitely want to get into the primal mind, as I said now, you know, portion of this. The website, your website, is primalbody-primalmind.com. Is that the best way for people to go that want to read more about the book and pick up a copy and so forth?
Yes, yes. They can go to my website. They can also sign up for my newsletter. I encourage people to do that. There's a tremendous amount of free information there, and there are also quite a number of free podcasts that are available for people to listen to as well, with a tremendous amount of very, very useful information.
And you have a recipe section as well for people who want to take a look at that for some ideas, I guess, and suggestions of what kind of food we're talking about here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's a lot that's very palatable, and you really don't ever have to be left feeling like you're living on cardboard. it's there are times where I kind of where I think, oh my gosh, it's hard to believe that something so decadently delicious could be something so incredibly good for me.
Very good. Again, the website, primalbody-primalmind.com. We're going to talk more about this here in the next segment. Stay with us, Nora. We'll be back with more after this break. We'll get into some specifics on what our ancestors probably ate. Nora also talks about the liberating aspects of the paleo diet. Then we'll cover carb dependency, fat, cholesterol, blood sugar, adrenaline, cortisol, and serious health issues linked to high carb diets. Nora also shares research about mood and cognitive issues, stress hormones, and mental illnesses connected to high carb diets. She talks about how many are prisoners in their own nervous system because of what they eat and drink. We'll also talk about humanity's disconnection from the body, mind, spirit, and the earth. Nora draws a contrast from our ancestors who lived a holistic lifestyle. The paleo diet is reversing chronic diseases, relieving stress, lowering the impact on the environment, and changing people's lives. At the end, we talk about food and food storage for emergency preparedness. Very interesting continuation is coming up next. Check out our subscription options on redicecreations.com and get a hold of a membership and continue to listen to this program and all of our previous programs going back to 2006. We have a lot of material for you there, good stuff. So I hope you take some time to check it out. Next up on Red Ice Radio, we have Richard Grove from Tragedy and Hope. Then Peter Halldorsson from Iceland on his book The Measure of the Cosmos. Then we have Winter Lake, Alex Newman, Eric Karlström, Less Visible, Nils Axel Mörner, Freeman, Janice Barcelo, Drunvalo Melchizedek, Jordan Maxwell, and many more coming on the program. I hope you stay with us. You can tune in at any time, download, and listen when you please. Also, don't forget Tom Montauk coming up next on Radio 314, Lana's next guest. We'll be right back with Nora Gedgaudas. Thank you for staying with us.